Welcome to More Than Numbers, Population, Environment, and Human Rights. My name is Ken Weiss. I'm a former environmental reporter for the Los Angeles Times, now gone independent and affiliated with the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting in Washington, D.C. I want to thank Kat Lazaroff of Resource Media and Vicky Markham at the Center for Environment and Population for helping inspire and organize this session. And a special thanks to Megan Parker of the Woodrow Wilson Center, also in Washington, D.C. Not only did Megan do most of the heavy lifting in putting this session together, she is clever and resourceful enough to find the financial support to bring the panelists to Chattanooga, as well as a delegation of journalists from overseas from, I think it's Nigeria, Malawi, Kenya, Cambodia, Philippines, Uganda, and Pakistan. Did I get them all? Is that right? Okay, great. And in Zambia. Oh, thank you, Zambia. Yeah. I think this is actually a critically important step for SEJ, which has typically been a collection of U.S.-based journalists focused on domestic issues. I'm a longtime SEJ member, but I think it's time for us to start reaching overseas, to begin collaborating with our colleagues in various countries. We all seem to face pretty much the same challenges. And along those lines, I want to just sort of set the stage, if I can, with a short video that we put together, that I put together with colleagues at the Los Angeles Times for our Beyond 7 Billion series that ran last year. So it's about 5 minutes long.
Facing one of the biggest train wrecks in human civilization. How are we going to feed 9 billion people without trashing the planet at the same time?
This idea of thinking about population isn't driven by a single number.
How many people the Earth can support depends on natural constraints which we do not fully understand and human choices which we have not yet made.
We only have so many resources in this world. There are not infinite amounts of resource.
We live in a world today where nearly a billion people will go to bed hungry tonight.
We've got 85 million more births and deaths every year on this planet.
Big part of the story for reducing birth rates is investing in children, saving those children's lives, and creating an expectation that, yes, your children will have the chance to lead a healthy and productive life.
To have a population that the Earth can sustain, we need to look both at the population numbers and how much people consume. We can't take one without the other.
We currently consume resources on planet Earth as if the Earth were about 50% more productive than it actually is.
We've literally farmed a planet, and now we have to double that. And we don't have any frontiers left to discover.
We have a propensity to use up all available resources, and we're doing that with greater success than any other species on the planet.
We've got to figure out how to use resources more sustainably now so that they still exist.
It's our future. It's the young people's future. You know that we are compromising so dramatically by our inability to address what are absolutely addressable problems.
Thank you.
So we have three terrific panelists today that are going to lead us in a discussion about answering those questions and also looking at another one. That we're going to discuss more specifically, and that is, what do public health and women's rights have to do, and family planning have to do with environmental journalism? And just up front, just acknowledge, we all know, we have to, by necessity, cut topics into manageable pieces so that we can get them published and broadcast, and that's just the way things go. But in doing so, we often, the focus of the stories have to be relatively narrow. And more often than not, they have to fit into sort of a specific category to appease our editors. Is it an environmental story? Is it a health story? Is it a, is it a science story? You know, what kind of story is it? But as the world gets more crowded and we're all chasing the same resources, I think it's really important that we start thinking about this and questioning those assumptions and think more broadly, are these narrowly cast stories, are they going to appear naive and short-sighted as time goes on? And is it time to look at more of the connections between these various disciplines and these categories and basically bust our reporting out of these traditional silos? We're going to begin with an example. Someone who's faced similar questions in a completely different field. It's Dr. Gladys Kalimazuku-Soka, who was trained as a wildlife veterinarian at the University of London and North Carolina State. She is the founder and CEO of a small nonprofit group called Conservation Through Public Health in Uganda. And for those of you who don't know much about Uganda, it's a small country in East Africa, wedged between Kenya and the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's about the size of Oregon and just about as green. Oregon has a population of just under 5 million, as did Uganda in 1950. Now there's about 35 million people in Uganda, and the rate it's growing, it'll have three or four times that many people by mid-century. The country is famous for its mountain gorillas and chimpanzees, and you can find both in some forests, which is the only place on Earth you can do that. It's also, some of you who aren't familiar with it probably know of its infamous former dictator, Idi Amin, which inspired the popular movie, The Last King of Scotland. And I'm going to turn this over to Gladys and see if I can cue up the presentation. Okay. Gladys, please. And then pull the microphone in closer. Oh, you see the microphone.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm very happy to be here today. It's my first time to give a presentation at a conference with the journalists. Since I've started my career, I've given presentations in conferences which are non-veterinary, so this is one of the new ones. I'm going to talk about my work in Uganda, how we are, all the very issues that Ken talked about. He came out to Uganda and reported about our work. I actually first met Ken at the IUCN conference in Barcelona, and he came to our session on population health and environment, which was organized by the Woodrow Wilson Center, and asked, he said to me, I'm going to come to Uganda. And a few months later, he was there, which is great. My presentation will focus on the mountain gorillas. I do most of my work with the mountain gorillas. Mountain gorillas are critically endangered. There's only less than 1,000 left in the whole world. They're only found in two populations, Bwindi Impenetrable National Park and Virunga, which is the more well-known population. Thankfully, the numbers of gorillas are actually growing. The last census has shown that there's now 880, up from 780. We carry out gorilla censuses once every 4 to 5 years to fit in with the interbirth interval. The mountain gorillas' habitats. Gorillas are also only found in Uganda, Rwanda, and Democratic Republic of Congo. This is the mountain gorillas. The habitat of the mountain gorilla is severely degraded. When it was created as a national park in 1992, now going to Bwindi, people just had to stop cutting trees and they couldn't go any further. But that means that there's no buffer zone. The gorillas live in this forest. Sometimes they come out here and they don't know that it's no longer their land or their range, and they end up coming into conflict with the people. This picture was taken from the Bwindi side of Bwindi and overlooking to the Virungas. People live very far from the nearest health centers and have very little access to social services. All of this led to scabies skin disease outbreak in the critically endangered mountain gorillas. Scabies is not a disease that people think about when they think about global health. The more interesting diseases are tuberculosis, HIV, malaria. But scabies is a disease which is very symptomatic of people who are very poor and have very little hygiene and sanitation, just like people who get tuberculosis. And so the first time we got scabies in the gorillas, that was my very first case as the vet for Uganda Wildlife Authority. After setting up this new department, this is the first time for them to have a vet. And the main reason why I was recruited is because mountain gorilla tourism had just begun. And they were very concerned that because we share over 98% genetic material, the gorillas could pick up diseases from the tourists who come to visit them. Little did everybody know that they would actually end up picking up diseases from the people who have lived in their habitat for a very long time. And so when I got a report that the gorillas were losing hair and developing white scaly skin, I consulted with the vets working in Rwanda, and they had had a veterinary program going for a long time in the Virunga National Park with the Mountain Gorilla Vet Projects, and they said they had never seen scabies. I mean, they had never seen any gorillas losing hair and developing white scaly skin. So I went up with a vet from Kenya who had seen something similar in cheetahs in Masai Mara, and there were those that were heavily visited by tourists. And then we went over also with somebody who had ever worked with gorillas in Rwanda and was now here, and we found out that it was scabies. We treated the rest of the group, and this baby was dropped. The mother dropped the baby a few days later. It's rare for a gorilla mother to drop a baby as soon as it's died. They normally carry them for a week. But this baby was crying even during the visit. Ended up dying of pneumonia, having lost almost all its hair, and she was, I think, tired of it. But it enabled us to get a very good postmortem of this baby the next day when she dropped it, and we were able to find out that it's scabies, lots of mites. And a few years later, we found out that it came from people who are living around the park who have very little health care. So how did the gorillas get the scabies from the people? When you visit gorillas, you're only allowed a minimum of 5 meters distance from them. And even if the rules sometimes get broken by the gorillas or the people, you still don't touch them. So we found out that the gorillas, we believe that they got it when they come out of here and they like to eat the banana plant. They actually eat the plant and destroy it, which also is another issue because it creates more wildlife conflict with people because they actually destroy people's livelihoods. So they came and destroyed this banana plant, and I asked this particular farmer whether he thinks gorillas are important when it happened, and he told me that he does because his children are employed by the park. Money from tourism goes to the community. In Uganda, it's now an act of parliament that 20% of park entry fee has to go to the community. He said, but the individual farmer like me whose crop gets destroyed, I'm not getting compensated. And up to now, 20 years later, compensation is still a major issue. So this led us to set up conservation through public health, where we promote biodiversity conservation by enabling people, wildlife, and livestock to coexist through improving their health and livelihoods in and around Africa's protected areas. Our vision is for people, wildlife, and livestock to live in balance, health, and harmony, with local communities acting as stewards of their environment. Actually, in Bwindi, the main issue is people and wildlife, people and gorillas. But in another national park where we're working, which is Queen Elizabeth, the issue is the wildlife and the livestock of the pastoralists who feel that they're entitled to live in the park because it's where they used to be before it was created. So what do we do in CTPH? We have three integrated programs. One of them is wildlife conservation, wildlife health monitoring, where we work very closely with the government to improve the health of the gorillas, make sure that they maintain their health and are able to survive. The next big program is the human public health program, where we improve the health of the people based on the findings from this case study that we had. And this is a typical family in Bwindi. The children are almost all the same size. They're just 1 year apart, most of them. And most people typically have 10 children per family. So they even tell you that half my children are for going to school and half are for chasing the wildlife from the garden. So it's a really important issue. So what do we do? In the wildlife health program, we train the park staff to monitor the gorillas. Because when I was the UWA vet, we only dealt with emergencies. Sick gorilla, they have scabies, they have a rectal prolapse, they have a snare. We rush in to remove it. But sometimes we didn't know what caused the prolapse. So this prompted me to set up the Gorilla Research Clinic. And with this particular project, we are able to collect samples from the night nests regularly and be more proactive. I did my training in a postgraduate training in North Carolina Zoo, and we monitor the animals regularly, so I wanted to do the same in Uganda. So we actually trained the park staff to collect the samples. We want them to have ownership of this program, and we want the Wildlife Authority to have ownership. We also train them to identify gorillas, which are sick. We look at zoonosis. That's a major focus of our program. This is anthrax under the microscope, for those who don't know. We've had anthrax in hippos in Queen Elizabeth National Park, killing over 300 hippos and some people who ate them and who didn't know that the hippos had anthrax. And we've also had anthrax in chimpanzees in the Thai forest in Ivory Coast. So on top of Ebola, which you may have heard of in Central Africa, we're also very worried about anthrax. It kills animals and kills the people who eat them. This is another founder member of CTPH, Stephen Rubanga, who's looking at anthrax under the microscope. My husband is a founder member too, and he focuses on the livelihoods section. He introduced the telecenters in the park. We had the ambassador of America coming to visit us, and he was able to look under the microscope and get a presentation from Stephen, and we get tourists who come and visit and learn more about our issues and give donations. We improve the health of the livestock. Often the gorillas graze next to the livestock, and in this particular instance, we're looking at Jadia. We commonly get Jadia when we travel. I've had it several times, and it's terrible because you're vomiting and you have diarrhea, so you feel like you're going to die. This student from University of California, Davis, vet student, managed to get some funding to do a study. We told him what we wanted, and he got funding to do the study. And we look at Jadia in the gorillas, the livestock, and the people, symptomatic humans, through a partnership with the hospital. So we're able to look and see that it was present in the people and the livestock. Now, with the Human Public Health Program, which is something new for somebody who's a vet, it actually started in my last year at Uganda Wildlife Authority. Everybody kind of realized that people were not only having dirty clothing, but they were not covering their rubbish heaps, the children were defecating in the garden, and they felt that we needed to set up a health education program. So went ahead and designed these brochures, and the community actually were able to tell us. When I actually went out, I began to start to work with communities in my last year. I had all this, the answers to their problems, I thought. So I told them this is the problem, and I was about to tell them what the solution was, but the community conservation ranger touched my hand and said, let's hear what they have to say. So they gave much better solutions than I had proposed. So that really humbled me, because I thought they're poor, they're uneducated, but no, it actually did. But one other interesting thing that came out of this workshop is that the women were inspired to educate their girl child, because they saw me out there leading this team of people to give this presentation. And this will come up later when we talk about population. So this is Cheshero Primary School, which is a school which one of our staff went to, who was the first female graduate from the area. And this lady is Hope. Hope has become a conservation leader in her community. She's giving a village health talk, talking about conservation and public health issues which are affecting the gorillas and conservation. We started to work also with traditional healers, believe it or not. I used to be very cynical about them until we started this program. This lady over here is Vasta. She was having her first child at the age of 25. Normally, by the age of 25, most people have had 5 children in our community, and by the age of 36, they've had 10. And this is her father, who's a senior traditional healer in the area. Her parents were able to take her to school in Kampala, and she got a Bachelor of Tourism because of Bwindi Impenetrable National Park. And so she came back and started to work with us. And the traditional healers, we're actually getting them to refer people who have TB, because everyone goes to them first, and then they can become their volunteer to make sure that they take the TB treatment. And as we do, as look for TB suspects, we also ask them how much interaction they're having with the gorillas. The gorillas and the people continue to mix. Even when this scheme was set up in order to improve the quality of life for the people in the area, it's a microhydro dam in the Bwindi Forest. You find that the gorillas are crossing this dam, and this same water is coming from the forest and going to the community and the livestock. Everybody's contaminating the water. So this is over here is one of our staff, Joseph Benaneme, community health coordinator, talking to the communities about water quality, how not to contaminate the water sources. And on top of that, we also look at hygiene, looking at whether people have clean water storage containers, whether they have hand washing facilities outside the toilet. And we actually found that where they didn't have protected water sources, the containers tended to be dirtier than where they did. So how did we get involved in family planning? I think part of what I've been saying has shown why we eventually got involved in family planning. But as I mentioned, people have too many children to look after. This is a flip chart that we developed, which basically shows, you know, this lady, it's a typical situation in Bwindi. And this flip chart was developed together with the volunteers who we selected. And in this flip chart, there are 10, you know, this lady's already had 10 children and another one's on the way. Half are going to school, half are not. And eventually in this story, as a bad family, her children end up getting teenage pregnancies and they end up dying and marrying early and abandoning their wives. And then in the good family, you know, they plan before they have a family and they end up having 4 children. And when the gorillas come into their garden, they call out the human and gorilla conflict resolution team to chase the gorillas back. Whereas the first family just goes out and poaches, hunts, and tries to chase them themselves. And eventually the good family, the children become rangers and nurses, and they ask the community, which one would you rather be? So with the village health and conservation teams, which were really set up properly when the family planning program began, the local leaders said they wanted one person per village to go and educate people about health and conservation issues. And so these people go out to educate about all these issues. They talk about the benefits and methods of family planning. They promote hygiene and sanitation. Most diseases are due to poor hygiene and sanitation, including scabies, TB. They refer TB suspects and HIV suspects. They talk about gorilla conservation, sustainable agriculture. And then at the same time, we taught them to give injections because Depo was the most popular contraceptive over there. So this lady, Rehema, is giving an injection to someone at her home. And this lady, before this program came about, she would have to walk 20 miles to the nearest health center, normally on market day. And she gets there and she finds a nurse who's overworked at a hospital like this with so many sick children, and she may not even get to her. And then she may end up conceiving. So with this program, Rehema follows her up, and she always keeps her days, and she gets a shot. Of course, the biggest problem with conservation and any program that you're doing in development is sustainability. And we are now sustaining our village health and conservation teams in different ways. We've given them bicycles. We've given them cupboards to keep the depot Provela injections. And we provided them with livestock as a group activity. And more recently, they now reinvested it into village saving and loan associations. So the area where it's working well, it's working really well. This is actually a nurse from the hospital. And these are some people from the hospital. So whenever we meet with the volunteers, we meet with people from Uganda Wildlife Authority and people from the hospitals. What has this resulted in? We've had a 12-fold increase in new family planning users, and over 60% of the women in the 2 parishes we're working in are now on family planning. So actually we find that the new users are going down and the old users are going up because we've covered most of them. It's much higher than the national average. We've had a 50% increase in hand washing facilities, clean water storage containers, and we've had an 11-fold increase in people being referred for TB. And on the conservation side, I've actually divided it up into health and conservation because depending on who you're talking to, and especially the conservation donors are like, how is this contributing to conservation? It's reduced human and gorilla conflict. These community volunteers reach the hardest to reach homes. And These are the homes that other conservation programs have never been able to reach, because when you call them for a meeting, they're too far away. They're busy chasing wildlife from the garden. The children are not even going to school. And we found that after 20 years of integrated conservation and development initiatives, the poorest of the poor were not being reached, and they were still poaching and collecting illegal resources from the forest. So we've helped to reduce human and gorilla conflict, because they also report the homes that are visited by gorillas, and then the Hugo team comes out and chases them. We've reduced incidences in the gorillas, disease incidences, since the program began. We've not had another scabies outbreak, and we've had very few outbreaks at all. And also, we're able to tell when one or two gorillas are sick and handle it before it gets too late. And we've also had improved conservation attitudes. I've put perceived, because whenever somebody goes and interviews our team or the volunteers, they tell you people are no longer poaching because they're happy with the program. Some of us have goats. People are happy. You know, generally people are very happy that because you're caring about their health, they feel happier to support conservation. And this is something that we want to measure more accurately. I think more importantly, we've got the women to become leaders in their community, conservation leaders. In order to spread the impact of our program, we started doing advocacy, and Population Reference Bureau has supported us to develop these fact sheets. And we also work closely with other groups like IUCN, Straight Talk, Tree Talk, and other groups, Uganda Network for Toxic Free Malaria Control. We also have public health groups like Family Health International, who we also work closely with. One of our things that we want to do is to have a more permanent structure where we work. And so we're building a community health and gorilla conservation center in partnership with the Uganda Wildlife Authority. We find that if you do things in partnership with the government, they're more likely to last. And anyway, it's the government supposed to be doing it anyway. So it's better that you work more closely together and it's sustained and a group effort. So we'd like you to tell people about the issues facing great apes. Sign up for our monthly newsletter. Visit us. Make a donation on our website. And we want to continue the meetings and the outreach that we're doing right now. We want to continue the gorilla health monitoring. And we want to scale up to other protected areas in Uganda. And, of course, we're fundraising for this big center. I wanted to say that we're celebrating 10 years of CTPH this year. And over the next year, 10 years, we want to scale up to other areas. We started working in Virunga National Park as well, in DRC, where people are even poorer. And they shocked us by saying they really want family planning because it's going to reduce poverty in their community. And that's the main reason why they want it, in spite of it being a very Catholic area. And actually, in our work in DRC, which is being supported by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, we've also found that they have to buy contraceptives. The family planning programs haven't arrived yet, which provide free contraceptives, unlike Uganda. But we've set up a similar program. We're monitoring the gorilla health. We're working closely with the Congolese Wildlife Authority veterinarian. And we also have a program in Mount Shabirimo with gorilla organization and improving the people's health. We'd like to thank you all very much. We want to thank Woodrow Wilson Center, SCJ, and all our partners and donors. And for more information on CTPH, please visit our website. Thank you.
Thanks, Gladys, and thanks for coming all the way to share that with us. Moving down the continent a little bit, we're going to next up is Dingaan Miti. He's a writer from Malawi, a small country in southeast Africa. Dingaan is a journalist and an activist. He writes for Interpress Service, Radio Netherlands, the Daily Times, and The Nation. He's also active in promoting safe motherhood and fighting against alcoholism, and the program manager of an advocacy NGO called Journalists Association Against AIDS. It's also a small country, about the size of Ohio, with about 15 million people. Its population is also set to triple in the next 40 years or so. Anyway, Dingaan.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here in Chattanooga. I want to talk about Malawi. Malawi is a very small country. Malawi is about... So Malawi is a very small country. It's about 118,000 square kilometers, about 15 million people.
So the issue of rapid population growth in Malawi is quite a very, very big issue. And when we're talking about rapid population growth, family planning comes into play. For example, the unmet family planning need in Malawi is about 26%. What do we mean when we're talking about the unmet family planning need? What we're trying to talk about is women who don't to adopt a certain method of family planning or birth control, but they cannot access that particular type of birth control because of different obstacles. So it's about 26%. And also, you look at a country like Malawi, whereby we have a fertility rate of about 5.6%. It means, on average, a Malawian woman has got 6 children. Of course, here in Uganda, they're talking about, in the community where they're working, about 10 children per woman in a family, but Malawi is about 6 children per woman. And this particular rate, the decline has been very slow, because like around 1992, it was about 6.7%. So about 7 children per woman. This is 2013, you are talking about 5.7%, about 6 children per woman. So why are we talking about population health and environment? What is the linkage between population health and environment? A very good example is there is a study which was undertaken in Malawi by the Wildlife Environmental Society of Malawi, and it was supported by the World Bank, talking about family planning, talking about climate adaptation, and disaster management. So the link between population health and environment is quite very critical for us to look into, and we feel it's critical for the media, policymakers to continue engaging. For example, in Malawi, the case study is that HIV has got a very huge impact on climate adaptation because it erodes human resources. People are very critical for environmental conservation, die because of HIV epidemic. And right now, Malawi has got an HIV prevalence of about 10.6%. Of course, it's declining just because of a very good and robust ART program which is in progress right now. So Malawi right now, for example, you find that the access to energy, for example, I can tell you that it's only about 3% of Malawians who have got access to hydroelectricity. Electricity is about 3% only. And about 88% of people in Malawi, they rely on firewood. So we find that there's a very huge strain of natural resources just because of this rapid population growth. And Malawi is highly urbanizing as well. So this rapid urbanization also gives a very huge strain on natural resources. That's why it's very critical to analyze the issue of population growth and also natural resources management. It's very critical. So Malawi, for example, I'm talking about electricity. Only 3% of the whole population of 15 million people have access to electricity. So the rest, 88%, depend on firewood. So this rapid population growth has got a very huge impact on these natural resources. And as a result, Malawi loses about $110 million in a year. This is based on the UN 2010 country assessment report. So $110 million can be translated to about 5.3% in the gross domestic product of Malawi. So Malawi is losing a lot, because we are not using our natural resources sustainably, because we are failing to manage our population growth. So the linkage between population health and environment is quite very clear, and we feel while we are here in Chattanooga, we need to point out to each other to say, let's promote a PHR approach in whatever work we are doing. And actually, there are also recent studies linking the growth of the non-communicable disease burden, for example, diabetes, also linked to climate change as well. Because we find that urbanization itself has got a very huge impact on changing lifestyles, the habits of people, how people eat, the diet. And also we see that in highly urbanized societies, we also see an increase in car ownership. People don't exercise. Less physical activity. People don't want to exercise. As a result, people have got an unhealthy diet, and also see the burden of NCDs, for example, diabetes growing. Manawa's got a prevalence of about 5.6% diabetes. So 6 out of every 100 Manawas have got diabetes, for example. So these are some of the factors. So it's very critical to see how climate change, health, and environment, how these things link up. It's very critical to look into that. So Manawa gives us a typical example on how we could integrate PHE. So with a grant from Population Action International, they're based here in Washington, we started a program in 2010 whereby we're piloting PHE, whereby working with different media houses. We're also talking to government, working with policymakers. But the bottom line here is, let's promote family planning, because family planning is critical. One, family planning reduces HIV. Family planning is very critical towards environmental conservation, because once you have smaller family sizes, it's very easy to adapt to climate change. And like when you have larger family sizes, it becomes very difficult. And a very good example is in the Lower Shire of Malawi, where of course the huge Shire River, which flows to the Indian Ocean. There, the fertility rate is also about 5.7%, 6 children per woman. And normally this area is flood prone. When floods strike, it's a woman who struggles with the children behind, while the husbands are always away working. So we find that even our climate change wears even a feminine face as well. Women suffer a lot. And the women have got a very huge burden. They face a burden of climate change. So it's very critical to look into that as well. So, for example, what has Malawi done? In terms of political commitment, we see that Malawi, right now the political leaders are now starting to realize that it's important to reposition family planning, because it's critical to sustainable natural resources management as well. So right now, of course, we still lament the fact that although a budget line on family planning has been created recently, I think most of you are aware that last year London hosted the International Family Planning Summit. So Malawi made a commitment, the Malawian government, to say that they are going to create a budget line for family planning. We're happy, as an NGO, as also an organization, work with the media to say that now we have that budget line. But we still lament the flow of resources. Where is the money? Because right now, we're only talking about 26 million kwacha. 26 million kwacha, that's our local currency. You translate that into US dollars, it's about 75 to 76,000 US dollars. How can a country, how can you talk about family planning that small amount of money? So we still need more commitment from donors. And we know we've got the Paris Declaration on Energy Effectiveness, whereby we need to hold even donors accountable to ensure that a country like Malawi is able to manage its population growth. So right now, Malawi is at the crossroads. Malawi is facing rapid population growth. It's a very big issue. It's a political issue as well. So it's good that our head of state, President Joyce Banda, who is the only second female president in Africa, she's also a champion of safe motherhood, maternal health. We should also remember that family planning is critical to reducing maternal mortality as well as infant mortality. So Malawi right now has got a maternal mortality rate of about 675 per 100,000. It's still alarming for a country like Malawi. Malawi has never had any conflict. You can't compare Malawi to countries like Haiti in the Caribbean, countries like Somalia, which are war-torn. Why is it that Malawi is suffering to have such kind of a very high maternal mortality? So political will also comes into play. So as a media, we are very critical that we need to hold government accountable. When we are writing a lot of stories in the media, you give a lot of pressure to politicians, members of parliament. At least they start listening to say that there's some action which is happening. But if the media is silent, it's not doing anything. Politicians also tend to do their own kind of thing, and then you find that the situation just goes out of control. So population health and environment is quite very critical, because you see that the linkage of non-communicable diseases is there, climate change causing food insecurity, because Malawi is also one of the climate change hotspots. Population Action International have done some mapping. Malawi faces water stress, agricultural decline, and all these things are closely linked to this rapid population growth. So that's why it's very critical to take a PHE approach in whatever work we're doing right now. It's very critical. So, for example, I can also just give you a quote, and I quote, This is a quote from the Catholic Church. You know the Catholic Church, is there anybody here from the Philippines? No. Yeah, Philippines is also dominated by Catholics, a lot of Catholics in Philippines. Malawi has also got a very huge Catholic community. So earlier this year, the Catholic community in Malawi, they released a pastoral letter. You know, that was against family planning, issues of abortion. Here I quote, judging that abortion is immoral is a very important Christian step in the direction of respecting and protecting life. End of quote. So from this quote, you can see that the position of the church, Catholic Church, on its own, they don't want family planning. So it creates a conflict on the civil society. How do we convince, like, the church to come to our side to say that Malawi is facing rapid population growth? Family planning is one of the key strategies in effective climate adaptation.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, we'll pick that up in a bit, and we can talk more about the Catholic Church. Our third and final speaker comes from another small and exotic locale. It's the District of Columbia. It's too small to be a state, but it has its own silverbacks that have been beating their chests and bluff charging and posturing, you know, and debating whether our federal government will remain shut down. Kate Shepherd is here from the wilds of D.C. She's written for Grist, spent years in the Washington Bureau of Mother Jones, and recently moved over to a paying job at the Huffington Post. And Kate is here to sort of help pull this together, talk about some of our policies in the United States, our struggles with this issue, make some of the connections between environment and public health and family planning and such, and also launch a discussion about how is it to write about this topic that can be taboo at times.
And I have to say, I want to differ. Washington has enough people to be a state. We do not have legislative support to be a state. I'm all for statehood. I cover environment and I cover, I have covered gender and sexuality and contraception, and I haven't come up with a really good title for my beat yet. I like to call it lady stuff sometimes, but I think that's also really a bad way of framing it because I think it's an issue for everyone, not just women. I think often, you know, I have these conversations with people, and, you know, recently I was talking to a member of my family, and they said, oh, what are there, 6 billion people in the world? And I said, you know, actually it's 7 billion now. We got that extra billion people pretty fast. I think a lot of people probably haven't even realized that we now have another billion people in the world. So I think, you know, a lot of important part of writing about these topics is just making people, I think, in the U.S. particularly, aware of the fact that, you know, how fast we're growing as a population and how much that is constraining resources around the world, but also here in the U.S. as well. I think there's a lot of U.S. perception that, you know, that there's infinite resources and that, you know, this isn't something we need to think about. But I think as a reporter, a lot of our job is to make people aware of the population issues and the constraints on resources out there. I think also, you know, I cover these two issues, but, in the environmental community, I think there has been for some time a reluctance to talk about population as it relates to the environment. You know, there was some nasty stuff, I think, that was going on in the early 70s around this issue and sort of about population control. And I think the, you know, justified backlash to that made a lot of groups shy away from even talking about the issue for quite some time. But I think now that's actually starting to change. You're seeing more environmental groups here in the U.S. who are talking about the issue. Sierra Club has a program devoted to it. Union of Concerned Scientists also has a program as well. And I think that they've come a long way in terms of figuring out how to talk about these issues in a way that relates to them, but is also responsible and, you know, doesn't talk about control, but talks about, I think, empowering especially women in other countries and also providing the kind of resources that people need to make those decisions about the size of their family and how they want to live, and actually sort of does that in a positive way. I think we're seeing more of that now, and I think that's creating more opportunities to cover some of the positive programs, I think, that are happening out there on this front. I think a lot of that's also because I think we're seeing more women and younger people who are engaging on these issues and are seeing the nexus of the issues and working, I think, in creative ways to join the issues together. I'd say, though, you know, in general, these issues are treated as two very separate issues, and I'm guilty of as much. I would cover, you know, I'll cover my gender, sexuality, reproductive rights story, and then I'll have my environmental story, and I often don't they don't always overlap. Occasionally they overlap, but not that often. Except I had, you know, a story recently where it was about how an anti-abortion group in the U.S. was being funded by this billionaire who had made all his money off of hydraulic fracturing. So that was one of those rare circumstances in which my pieces collided. But, you know, often I do see them. They often end up being separate stories. But I think there's a lot of ways to sort of combine the issues and to find sort of where the linkages are. One for me is looking at contraception and unplanned pregnancy in the U.S. I mean, even here in the U.S., where, you know, we think that we have these problems solved, half of pregnancies are unintended. We're still having a giant fight about contraception here in the U.S., let alone trying to talk about how we can do a better job of making it accessible abroad. You know, some things I've seen where we can cover this is a lot of, you know, U.S. policy as it relates to other countries. I had a story a few years ago about a U.S. lawmaker who was traveling to Kenya to try to discourage them from decriminalizing abortion in their new constitution. And it was, you know, it's sort of appalling that those things are happening and that there's, you know, countries are trying to, I think, do the right thing and make reproductive health care available to women, a wide variety of it, but we still have U.S. politicians trying to directly stop that. But then you sort of have the sort of policy issues as well, where we're still actively discouraging, you know, the Obama administration reversed the Bush administration's policy of not providing funding to any organization abroad that would even talk about abortion as an option. You know, the Obama administration did reverse that, but we've seen efforts in Congress as well to try to bring back that policy and not fund any kind of program abroad that talks about abortion, which does hurt a lot of groups who are doing really good work on providing contraceptive care. And so I think, you know, covering those policy issues in the U.S. as it relates to other countries is a way I think that we can sort of talk about how these things relate to each other. I think another way, and we talked about this a little bit when we're planning for the panel, is I think in the U.S. another way that we can have really constructive conversations is around environmental health politics as well. And, you know, I think there's a lot of interest in the U.S. about how, you know, pollutants and toxics in our environment affect, you know, women's reproductive health. And so I think that creates a new opportunity to engage people in the U.S. on the issues that they already are naturally inclined to care about, I think. And so I think that's another way we can do better reporting that brings these issues together.
Great. Thanks, Kate. We're going to open this up to questions now, and hopefully we can get a good discussion going about this. Are there any, or I'll throw out the first one. Since I don't see any hands, let me just start. Gladys, you mentioned that you learned to listen to the communities and find out what they wanted. Can you just describe the sort of very briefly what's a typical life like for a woman? And when you talk to a woman around Windy Impenetrable National Forest, what do they say they want in their lives?
I think, Ken, when you visited Windy, you also got an idea of that, but you know, when you speak to the women in Windy, actually, before we started the family planning program, we got a university nearby, Imbara University, to do an assessment of the need for family planning. And they were very scared. They all had a lot of myths and misconceptions about family planning. They were very scared to get on it. But once we began, they were quickly liberated because they'll tell you that, you know, now I don't have to have a baby every year. I can do something else with my life. I can start a business. A lot of them like to start up goat enterprises. For example, the Uganda Wildlife Authority new revenue sharing program. We recently approved it because I'm now also on the board of UWA. That the money is not only going to go to infrastructure, but also to community enterprises. So a lot of them have proposed to do goat enterprises. They, you know, they want it more for their life than just having a baby every year. So in fact, they used to tell us that they would go they like that injection because they could go tell their husband they're going on market day and they get a shot and he doesn't know. But unfortunately, then the husbands may end up beating them because they're saying, why aren't you having babies? So we told them to make it sustainable, you really have to talk to your husband about it. And so our volunteers, village health and conservation teams, actually carry out couple peer education so that both the man, husband and wife agree to this family planning method. For example, there's a lady who's a leader in her community. She had had 9 children, and she had the implant based on the outreach from the volunteers, and she was having side effects, bleeding. So a nurse midwife who had employed spoke to her about it, and she was beginning to accept, and the side effects were going down. So I said to her, are you willing to go on radio and talk about it? She said yes. Then I actually asked her, but why don't you just have a tubal ligation? You've had 9 children. And do you really want to have any more? And she said, I wanted a tubal ligation, but my husband said no. He's okay with the implant, but not with the tubal ligation. And I thought, well, that's progress. So she went on radio with her husband and the volunteer. And after that, many people wanted to get family planning. So I think when we get the women, and also when the women become conservation leaders as well, then the children follow, because the women spend a lot of time with the children. And the children also influence their parents more. So I think it's, you know, when they start telling you women are no longer having babies every year. Yes, it's hard to measure the family size, whether it's reduced straight away, but they'll tell you women are no longer having babies every year. So I think it's making a big difference to their lives, and it's making a big difference to the way that they perceive, you know, quality of life and how it's relating to conservation.
Yes. Can you identify yourself, please, and speak up?
Is just an environmentalist. So while they have an insurance for livestock and they get all the men together, they haven't worked, they've never thought of working with women and then expanding their services to health. And I think it's a very good idea, and when I go back, I'm going to write to them to take up this, or at least talk to you or find you out on the net.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, I'd like to talk to them and see as well how the program is going and how we can integrate this.
Making sure that, you know, the community doesn't kill the snow leopard, which mm-hmm. they were doing when the snow leopards were attacking the livestock.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that part is all right there. But as far as, you know, getting women involved, they've done nothing. And that is because it's headed by a man. Mm-hmm. Probably he never thought of this.
I'm going to turn that around into a question. Is there a way that you can then reach beyond the male, traditionally male leaders of these communities to talk about these issues?
I think as reporters we need to find the women and talk to them as well.
Mm-hmm.
I see often many organizations where there's a man at the head and then you just talk to the person at the head and happens to be a man and don't really engage women's voices in a meaningful way. So speaking as a reporter, we need to engage more women in the conversation. But
I mean, we were very lucky that when we're selecting the volunteers, we went to the local leaders and said, you know, who would you like to be the volunteer? Because we were employing a man from the community, and he was proposing all his relatives. And I said, no, that's not going to work. Those are the advantages, disadvantages of working with employing people from the community. So I said, let's call the local leaders. And actually, it was a pleasant surprise that half the people happened to be men and half happened to be women. And so we find actually with this approach the women get more involved in conservation and the men get more involved in family planning and, you know, reproductive health issues.
Oh, interesting. In the back there. Yes.
Yes, I'm here visiting as a speaker, myself, on the panel tomorrow. One of the comments I wanted to make was the unity or the joining fate of empowering women, like you say, in conservation, in the environmental area. Because I think that's a place, especially for
mm-hmm.
that can build the education systems that help their children get educated and get jobs, etc. So I think there's a nice pairing between empowering women to have a whole lot of sustainability and low-income economy, especially in the future.
Okay. questions? Yeah, in the back. Yeah. Mm.
The last point about environmental contaminants, I think, is an interesting one with women's health. And I assume you're talking kind of construction and things like that with birth defects and women's health. I was wondering if you have any tips writing-wise on bringing that in an engaging way, because not only is the science kind of uncertain to some extent, but it's also kind of a drive and academics and
I think there's actually been some interesting things happening in the medical community on this front. Like, what was it, the week before last, we had the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists coming out and saying, basically coming out in support of Toxic Substances Control Act reform, which is another dry topic, since we're talking about dry topics. But I think that you can probably, by getting members of the, like, talking more to members of the environmental community about why, or sorry, the medical community about why these environmental risks are interesting to them, and maybe make it a little bit more exciting. This hospital reform is pretty dry, but I think it was a really big deal to have ACOG come out and say that this is a big issue.
ACOG.
American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists.
Thank you.
So that's one way. I mean, I think there's a sort of, you're right, like, it's very hard to communicate, you know, the science behind it is still developing, and I think that's why that was an interesting development, because they're saying we need more testing, we need more information out there. This is why we should be, you know, actually regulating testing substances at a federal level. So getting those voices out there more, I think getting more women's and moms' groups' voices out there too. I mean, I think there's been some movement on getting those communities more engaged on the issue too. I think it is a challenging way, I think, to make it come off the page, but I think that there are sort of more people getting involved that can make it more of an interesting dynamic for storytelling purposes.
Question? Yes.
I'm Kanya Yarmida, the professor. Another question for Dinkan. I mean, it's interesting that you identify yourself as a journalist and an activist, because I tend to wear both those hats too, and then it's also always kind of walking a fine line between what you're able to report on, journalistically speaking, as opposed to, you know, the activism work that you're doing. So how are you able to navigate that line between covering issues that are very close to you and also, you know, maintaining kind of journalistic distance from that?
Right.
Especially on the issue of HIV/AIDS, which is obviously so controversial
everywhere. Yeah, thank you so much, Kanya. In the case of Malawi, the situation is like, where I'm working with an NGO, which is independent. Our organization is like, we provide support to different media houses, journalists, the huge network of journalists we're working with across Malawi. So in the past, what I've done is like last year, with support from NFPA, we trained local reporters in reporting population health and environment. Really, it's an arena which is challenging, because I have to do like public relations work for my organization. So I specialize in features myself. I write a lot of features for population health and environment as part of promoting the projects or implementing at our organization as well. And it's very hard, because we have to convince editors sometimes for stories to come out in the papers. Population health and environment is a topic which is very complex, and to convince editors to have these stories to appear is not something which is easy. Yeah, so we need to invest a lot of time to do stories, link with editors, even made from the media themselves, the journalists who are working with the reporters on the ground. Because they also come to our organization, because our organization is also a center of excellence. It's also a resource center. So different media houses, journalists come to access information, population health and environment. But we're very lucky, because we're getting a lot of support from different partners, and one of them is Population Action International. They're here in Washington, they give us technical support, they give us publications. We also have a Population Reference Bureau also here in Washington, they also come to Mali, they're also very effective there, they're working, they're supporting us. So in short, just to answer your question, it's just a matter of being passionate, being able to invest your time, and also having that particular interest to isolate what population health environment is, and also to understand issues to do with population dynamics, sustainable development and climate change. The issues which are very quite complex. But with time, we are able to make progress, that we are able to go out, educate the general public, and also train with the media.
on how population and environment, how this impact and how they impact. So it's just a matter of being, just being strong, being passionate, to know what we want to achieve at the end of the day. But it's not easy because the resources are not there. And another issue is like, when I went to the COP17, the United Nations Conference of Parties, the United Nations Convention on Climate Change in Durban, roughly, the issue of climate financing is still a very huge challenge. Because at the end of the conference, world leaders agreed to create the Green Climate Fund, GCF, whereby some $100 million to be invested up to the year 2020 to help least developing countries to cope with climate change. But up to now, the GCF, the basket itself, still empty. So for a country like Mali, it's quite difficult, because even to support the media, to write these stories, it's not very easy, because the money for climate change is not there. And climate financing is a very big challenge.
Thanks, Daniel. Yes, Sam.
Sam, being a freelance reporter, connecting those dots in a way that translates to an audience. But one of my questions is for Gladys. As you were putting up the statistics up there, the health statistics were very striking.
Yes, you brought up a very good point. It is a lot harder to show that you're making a difference in conservation quickly than it is in public health. The public health indicators are so well developed, and people know that then it means that's going to get into a longer interbirth interval and a smaller family size eventually. But with conservation, we have very few indicators. It's like, has the animal population increased? You know, that's one. And for example, when I started my presentation, I said the gorilla numbers have recently gone up from 780 in total to 880 in total. And in Bwindi specifically, from just over 300 to 400. And we were all very happy when we got that news, because it's good news, the population is going up. We're hoping that all our combined efforts are helping, you know, making sure that the communities are not going to poach gorillas when they come onto their land or kill them, or they can tolerate them, which we've actually seen happening in Bwindi. For example, the old silverback Ruhendeza, when he got very old and he was kicked out of the group, he preferred to stay in community land. And I spoke to the volunteers and I said, you should tolerate Ruhendeza. Because of him, your community has developed, which is true. I mean, he was the first silverbacks group to be habituated in 1992, and because of him, you know, there's so many benefits to the community. And they said, you know, even when our old people get sick, we look after them. So they tolerated him taking an occasional banana plant and things like that. And so those and just things like that. They're willing to tolerate gorillas in their land and not kill them. It's hard. At least with vet, it's a little bit more direct, because you can say, you know, the incidences of disease has gone down. But in general, it's very difficult. Did the numbers go up because the gorillas are getting better health care? Did they go up because there's more law enforcement? The community attitudes are changing. There's more benefits to the community. It's a combination. So it's a bit harder. But you're right, it is a lot more difficult to tell whether. And donors don't understand this, actually. You know, they're like thinking, well, you know, what is the conservation outcome? And I think with conservation, it's so narrow. It's like, is it illegal activities in the park? Have they reduced? You know, and are the numbers going up? It's just two indicators. I don't know if we can come up with more in conservation, but I think maybe as we keep exploring this field, we'll come up with more. And it will really help to show that it's making a difference.
Let me just follow up on Gladys. Do you think it's harder to persuade conservation donors to be interested in public health and issues, or public health donors to be interested in conservation, or both?
I think it's both. Because when we started out the program, we actually got more support from the conservation donors. Because conservation, generally the protected areas are areas that no one wants to reach, and conservation groups are there anyway. So you see the poverty, it's just in front of you, you can't ignore it. And you know that when you improve their health, something will improve, especially when we knew that disease came from people to gorillas. But as you go along, then they start to say, yeah, but even with all these ICDs, they're like, are people collecting firewood less from the forest? Are they poaching less? So you find that as you go along with your programs, the conservation donors are beginning to question. Whereas with public health, it took a while to catch on to it. But now I think maybe they'll start to catch on to it more. So it's kind of a difficult one. But there's some donors who just get it. They get the linkages, they get the integration, and they want to support it. USAID is one of them with the PHE approach. MacArthur Foundation more recently is getting to PHE. And a few other groups, I think someone was surprised when I said US Fish and Wildlife Service is now supporting family planning in the Virungas. So I guess it's the way that you explain it, you know, and the way you bring across all the linkages that you can get them to see that it works both ways. But I think for me the biggest measure is the quality of life. I mean, if the communities are much happier about themselves, they're much more positive about conservation, they're willing to promote it, I think that's already showing success as far as conservation goes.
Yes, right here.
So I have to find out from the Uganda and Malawi perspective, you know, how has that played out, you know, do you find urban areas more open to adopting family planning as opposed to rural areas?
Okay. Oh, before we let's get one more question here. And we'll answer them all together. Okay, what are the guys? Okay. Go ahead.
Okay, all right. For my colleague from Zambia, Aneba, our neighbor. I think you have raised a very, very critical question. When we are talking about population dynamics, climate change, sustainable development, you know, the issue of education is very quite critical. Actually, surveys like the Malawi Demographic Survey, which was done for 2010, it shows that women who at least attend secondary school education, they have got smaller family sizes as compared to those in rural areas. So we find that in rural areas, most women get married at the age of 15. And Malawi, for example, is a country whose legal framework in terms of marriage age is not very clear. Because in parliament, MPs were fighting, of course, tussling, say, it's 15 years, is it 18? Right now, we're not yet very clear, because our women, very young women, they tend to get married very early, and then they tend to have high number of children. And also that also correlates to high maternal mortality. So you find that better education outcomes, if you educate more women, you empower more women with education. At least in most urban areas, women are able to access at least basic quality education, unlike rural areas. So you find that there, at least, there are more high levels of family planning whereby women who are more educated, they tend to access more family planning services than in rural areas. So I think it's an important issue to look at the education outcomes. How do we empower women? How do we educate our women? Because if you educate a woman, she's able to transform a community. So I think family planning also goes alongside education outcomes as well. That is very critical.
Thanks, Dingham. Do you want to add to that and also challenges in working with the government?
Yeah, I agree with Dingan that girl child education is very important. Vasta, who we employed, is a very good example. And that's something that should be taken up seriously. I think, for example, in Malawi, they should promote the girl child education a lot. Also, one thing that helped in our area, I think, is the way that we approached it. It was about, we started off with improving their health. You know, we're helping them, trying to reduce tuberculosis in the community. We're promoting hygiene and sanitation. We started off by improving their health. Then we brought family planning in. And so, actually, we also talked about HIV, then brought in family planning. So I think that was a good entry point. And also, we focused on balancing the family budget more than, oh, you're going to go and create too much pressure on the forest. It was easier to say it's about balancing the family budget. When you have fewer children, you can take them to school. They're less likely to get all these kinds of diseases. And once you take them to school, you break the poverty cycle. They don't just have to be a peasant digging the land. And so I think it's just the way you approach it. Maybe in Malawi, you can try and get them to engage the men at the beginning and tell them that, hey, you're going to be wealthier with fewer children. Even those people on the farm, you have that land that they're talking about for farming. You know, we have having land wrangles in Uganda because people are killing each other over land. The land is too little now for large families. So maybe you could approach it in that way as well, that there isn't enough land and your children will end up fighting with each other. Regarding challenges, there's quite a number of challenges, but I think maybe the biggest challenge is convincing people about the integrated approach and that it works. But obviously we have all the same challenges. We really need funding to continue this work. And it's good that in one area it's actually become sustainable because of village saving and loan associations and income generating projects. But it's very hard to get funding to continue this work for the same reasons. Convincing people that it's important and even finding the capacity, you know, getting good people to go out there and work in the field. We thought often that, okay, let's employ people from the community and train them up to do the work because it also creates more harmony with the community where we're working. Sometimes that's difficult. Capacity can also be a problem. The government has been generally supportive of the program, I can say, because our main partner is Uganda Wildlife Authority. And because I used to be the vet there, they trusted me when we started this program. They trusted me more than they would any other NGO coming in. And also the way that we approached it at the beginning is that we involved everyone from the beginning. So we had a strategic planning workshop. We invited everybody and asked them, what do you want us to do? This is what we want to do. We have an NGO called Conservation Through Public Health, first set up actually in America as a 501c3. I said, this is what we want to do. And we invited everybody. We invited people from Ministry of Health. We invited Uganda Wildlife Authority, the research community, the universities, a couple of schools, the tour operators, anyone who we thought would be a stakeholder for the future. The local government opened the workshop. The Ministry of Health closed it. And they came up with all the ideas. So I think we brought buy-in from the beginning, and that's kind of made it easier to work with everyone.
I think we're out of time, right? Aren't we supposed to finish a few minutes ago? But, Kate, you have last word? Since,
I don't think I have much to add.
Okay, all right. Well, why don't we thank our panelists, especially those who...